Welcome to American Masters Lennon NYC Beyond Broadcast. I'm Susan Lacey, the creator and executive producer of American Masters, and with me, as always on these podcasts, is Michael Epstein, the writer and director of Lennon NYC.
Hi, Susan. Sounding great today.
I know. I'm hoping I sound very sexy. I'm just getting over a cold.
You sound great, as always.
Today is really Beyond Broadcast in that we are publishing a set of interviews that did not make it into the final film. Colin Hall and Colin Hampton, both hailing from Liverpool. Michael, tell us about this.
Well, as you remember, when we were making the film, we for a very long time thought we were going to do John's childhood in Liverpool, sort of figure out a way to dovetail it into the program. Never really found a home for it. We tried it in a bunch of different places, but, you know, Liverpool was important to us, we thought, for a couple different reasons. One was that John sort of kind of felt like New York was familiar, and it felt a little bit like Liverpool. They were both dock cities. Liverpool had a great connection to New York. I mean, you hear about in the podcasts about all of the sailors on the Cunard liners who would come back from New York with American blue jeans and American rock and roll and American styles. They actually called them Cunard Yanks in Liverpool. And I think that it was one of the reasons why Liverpool was an entry point for American rock and roll, and not a surprise when you think about it why the Beatles came from Liverpool and not from London, you know, where you would maybe expect. But John also just felt, we thought for a long time, but, you know, it explains John's love of New York and his sense of familiarity. But the other reason was really that, you know, the film really ends with the Dakota and Sean and John's coming to peace and finding real redemption and having a family. And so I thought that it was important for a long time. I still think it's important. Just couldn't find a place for it to explain sort of the dislocation that John felt from his childhood. And the first interview is with a gentleman named Colin Hall, who even Beatle aficionados may not know because he doesn't really factor into John's life. He didn't know John, but he runs Mendips, which is John's childhood home in Liverpool, in the Liverpool section of Woolton, which at the time was a suburb when John was growing up. And it's now part of the National Trust. Yoko bought John's childhood home and restored it back to exactly as it was when John was growing up in the 50s in it. And Colin runs it and, you know, just knows everything about Liverpool because he hails from Liverpool, and about John. And, you know, I think I've talked to you about this in the past. John spoke of his childhood very much like he was an orphan. You know, Mother, all of these various songs about feeling that his parents were sort of dead and gone. And you know, I think that a little bit different, my take on it, was that his parents were around. You know, Freddie, his dad, didn't die until the late 70s, and he knew Julia all through his teens. Julia died when he was 18 or 17.
Did they see each other?
Well, they didn't. They did for, you know, he knew both of his parents through, say, five or six, but around the time he was about 6 years old, his Aunt Mimi took him in. And Freddie just sort of disappeared, and John never really understood why. And, you know, it was a very complicated relationship. Julia was a bit like John, actually. You know, she was a party girl, and she liked to party. And when Freddie was at sea, she actually got pregnant by a couple of other men. And she had many affairs. And there's a gut-wrenching story that I heard that, you know, never sort of made it into the film. It didn't even make it into our interviews, of Freddie trying to run away with John to New Zealand and taking him to Blackpool beforehand, and Julia kind of tracking him down. And John was six. And Freddie told Julia that he was going to take John away, and Julia just said, okay. Just said goodbye to her son and walked away. And John, as Freddie told the story later, was just beside himself and ran to Julia and grabbed her leg and held on to it tight and cried that his mommy wouldn't go. And so Freddie was going to go instead. It was clear at this point that Julia had had too many affairs, that there was no marriage there anymore. And so he said goodbye to John, and then John ran to Freddie and held on to Freddie's leg. And finally, they turned to John, who was all of 6 years old, and told him he had to choose between his mom and his dad.
Oh, my God.
In Blackwell. And this is 1946. And
it might have been easier for John to think they were dead.
Yeah, no, I think so. And, you know, the other piece of all of this is that around that time, his Aunt Mimi, who was childless and who was the sort of matriarch of the family, she was Julia's sister, and there was the very strong women in Julia's family. And Julia was very much, you know, the black sheep of the family. She stood out. And a lot of the ways that John, I think, later stood out. I think that John had a lot of Julia in him. Anyway, Mimi took him in with his Uncle George, and, you know, Julia started another family eventually. Down the road, she was there. She was a presence, but he didn't see her. And she never married Bobby Dykens, but they started another family. She never divorced Freddie. And she had two daughters with Bobby, John's half-sisters. And John started to reestablish contact with her around the time he was about 15, 16. She was actually at the church fete the day that John met Paul. And, you know, John always said that Julia taught him American rock and roll, taught him how to play guitar. Of course, she only knew how to play the banjo, so she taught him with only three strings instead of the five. And then Julia was hit by an off-duty police officer who was probably drinking. When John was about 17 or so. And it was one of the things that John and Paul shared, because Paul had lost his mother a year before to breast cancer. So they had that together. So anyway, Colin Hall knows a lot about him. And when I talked to Colin, you know, I talked not so much as John as an orphan, but John as an adopted child who was sort of abandoned by his kids. I mean, by his parents, knowing that they're kind of around, but they couldn't be bothered to raise him. And that struck a chord with Colin, and we decided to sit down and do an interview, which I think is a lovely interview. Does a nice job of explaining Liverpool after the war and John. And so we're including it here. It's not in the film. And then the other interview is with Colin Hampton, who was the original drummer for the Quarrymen, but who could not be bothered after Paul McCartney joined and George Harrison joined the band to continue to take his drum kit on the double-decker buses, and eventually just decided one afternoon after they got pissed at a really drunk at some event and John and Paul couldn't have cared less that they blew this gig, that he was out of the band. And so he quit what was to become the Beatles and created a drummer problem for Paul and John and George that was not solved until after the Decca recordings, when they brought on a gentleman named Richard Starkey, who they knew from Hamburg, Ringo Starr. So that's today's podcast.
Well, it sounds completely fascinating. Does Colin Hampton ever forgiven himself for this?
You know, he said he was perfectly happy to not be a Beatle. So there you go.
Thank you, Michael. I think this is going to be a great podcast. Very interesting. Join us next week when our podcast will be our interview with Earl Slick, the lead guitar on Double Fantasy. And be sure to tune in on November 22nd to American Masters on your local PBS station to see Lennon NYC. And to find out even more, check out our website, www.pbs.org/American Masters.
In the 50s, when it popped here, when it first came to Liverpool, how was it perceived?
Well, I think you have to remember that we're just coming out of the war here in Liverpool. Our city's devastated. 65% of the city centre has gone. And the UK is rebuilding. And suddenly from the United States there comes this kind of wild and raucous sound that is absolutely sensational. This is a revolutionary sound. You know, we're going through a trad jazz phase, if you can call it that, here in the UK, and this is something which the older generation can deal with, because of course jazz has been around for a while, but rock and roll is much more, put it this way, it's a much cruder sound. It's more raw.
Did you like it?
As a young boy, it's the first kind of music that I can remember. I can vaguely remember skiffle and Lonnie Donegan. But for me, I guess rock and roll was Elvis and particularly Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly, because I had a friend whose brother was a merchant sailor, and he came into Liverpool, and he would bring records back into the house. And Alan, his name was a great fan of Buddy Holly and the Everlys, the Everly brothers. So I would hear those records.
How did you get them?
Well, he was a merchant sailor, and he was traveling to the US as part of his work. And the impact of Alan on me, I remember going into my friend's, his younger brother was Edward. Edward was my friend. And I'll never forget the first time I saw Alan, who was fresh from off the boats. He'd just come back from New York, and he was standing in Edward's living room, and there he was in his powder blue jeans, and he had his crepe sole shoes on. He had a white T-shirt, and the sleeve was turned over to hold his packet of cigarettes, and he had the hair greased back and the Elvis kind of quiff, the Tony Curtis kind of look. And for me, this was radical, because this was something I'd never seen before. And
it was radical here.
And this was the look that was coming over, because the Liverpool has always enjoyed a particular relationship with the United States. You know, it is this. There's been this cultural exchange, really, between the two cities, because of course people are coming from... It's a point of entry, you know, and people are coming through Liverpool to go to America, and then people are coming back from America, and we're going to the cinema, and what are we watching? We're watching Westerns. We're watching detective films, but particularly Westerns. And on the television in the mid-50s, just beginning to kick off in the UK, and children's television quite often was cowboy films, you know, short half-hour programs. In the evening, you get the detective series. You get this vision of New York and places with skyscrapers and screaming cars. And it's different to the UK. And, of course, this is...
But one of the things that you said, and this is in particular about American rock and roll, things coming from America were not... seen as great cultural...
Not by our parents.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, not by our...
By Mimi, say.
Well, Aunt Mimi... Aunt Mimi, I judge as being a very typical parent of her generation. She has come through the war, and I don't think you can ever underestimate, you know, what people experienced in the war. Here in Liverpool, bombs were raining down on this city. And I think suddenly, you know, this has been it's been a hugely traumatic experience. But then stuff like rock and roll is so frivolous, it's so trivial. It seems to be, you know, the parents' vision of this would be that it's of no intrinsic value. You know, it is here today and gone tomorrow. It's played...
It's a fad.
It's of no real substance. It's got no roots. It's got nothing in it that they can see is going to elevate.
It's the worst of America.
It's reducing things to a lowest common denominator. Okay? It's working class. It's blue collar, whatever you want. And so instead of raising the sights, it's lowering them. And it's also something which it's something that's popularity is very wide.
It's not British, right?
It's not British. It's not British. It's persuading our kids to chew gum, to to wear grease in their hair, and to speak and dance in ways that we're not used to. You know, there's a great informality to it, and that's a big thing, because Britain, in my parents' day, when I was a little boy, formality and convention. And being conservative, and I mean this in British terms with a small c, is the way forward. We're a very traditional, class-ridden society, still in the 1950s, and rock and roll is perceived as subversive. This is something which is challenging the established order of life in the United Kingdom. You know?
So John is John Lennon is turned off by that because he wants to keep everything conservative.
No, John Lennon's turned on to it. John Lennon is turned on to it because he is a creative spirit, you know, and he may not even realize it himself at that age. You have to remember, we're talking about John when he's 16, 17. But something was awoken in John Lennon by rock and roll. His famous quotation was, "Before Elvis, there was nothing." And I think that maybe says it all. I think it's maybe not accurate either, because for John, there was lots. There was the Goons, which was anarchic humour, anti-establishment. Here we have a little something in British culture that John is latching onto because it's mocking the establishment. You know, and Spike Milligan. It's very much taking the rise out of the establishment, you know, politicians, the armed forces, you know, the church. And it's doing it through humour. And
well,
humour is a powerful weapon for John.
The Pythons all follow a very straight line of British humour that's not... That's an integral part of British society. And, you know, the Goons are in that continuum.
It is. It's... Well, I guess it's not satirical in the sense that we had something called Beyond the Fringe, which was very satirical, and it attacked the establishment. The Goons attacked the establishment by lampooning it. You know, all the characters were crazy. They all seemed as if they were mad, and they spoke in very strange voices. And for the British underclass, if you like, or working class, this was a great way of having a laugh at those toffee-nosed people who were in charge of the country.
And John loved it.
Well, John loved it. It was, I would say, hugely influential in a way that rock and roll was, because it was going against the old order, the traditional values, if you like.
So what is it about Elvis or Chuck Berry or Little Richard, Buddy Holly, the Everlys? What is it that captures the youth of Liverpool and John?
Well, I think for a start, it's not just the music, it's the way that they look as well. You know, they're challenging perceptions, they're opening doors, and they're saying, you know, the music that you've been listening to, it doesn't always have to be that straight-laced. Listen to the rhythm and the words that they're singing about, things that kids could connect with, children, teenagers could connect with.
Did it matter that it was American? Did anybody?
Well, I think it was more exciting because it was American. You know, Lonnie Donegan had started with Skiffle, but the songs he was singing were American songs about Rock Island Line, and then there was Nancy, I've forgotten his name now, and Chas McDevitt who sing about Freight Train. These are not English things, but they're American, and they connect with the visual experience that we're getting from Hollywood. And, of course, you know, some of the literature coming out of the USA. So what you're having is a collision here of these different cultural items coming out of the USA. And they are exciting because the USA is an exciting place. You know, it's futuristic to us.
It's free of class.
And that's another thing, you know, it doesn't look...
Freedom.
Exactly. It's a freedom of expression which wasn't available at that time or was kind of looked down on. And so what you have is young people like John, who has this great bubbling talent, suddenly realises that it's okay, that you don't have to be archaic, that, you know, here is an opportunity to express yourself in the language that his friends will understand, that they all understand, but it's located in the language of the USA.
And a language that people like his Aunt Mimi just find incomprehensible, right?
Yeah, I guess they couldn't understand the attraction of it, you know, and don't forget they...
Did your parents understand the attraction of it?
Oh, God, no. My father in particular had been in the army, he'd served in the war, and these guys with the longish hair and the way that they dressed, he was critical of the American soldiers. They didn't wear proper uniforms, you know, they were sloppy. Okay, you guys were sloppy. And And I think this was a pervading attitude because we were more regimented. You know, we had the class system.
Blue jeans were not, right?
No, they were working trousers, weren't they? You know, that you wore those to work and not to go out in. And of course, there were many places that wouldn't let you go in jeans. Jeans were revolutionary.
So Julia also looks askance at all of this stuff coming over from New York and America?
Well, from all that I've read, I think Mimi represented the kind of the traditional values and generation. Julia was more open to this more, if you like, bohemian or revolutionary kind of attitude. I think she had that artistic quality that, of course, she passed on to John. There was...
You know, there's a part of me that sort of, my heart goes out to Julia because I get the sense that she didn't fit in.
You know, I think she was before her time in her attitude and her openness. I think she would have flourished in the 60s. That would have enriched her spirit, if you like.
You know, there's the cliche, the black sheep of the family, and, you know... But there is a quality of Julia where you get the sense that she was out of time. She didn't...
Well, I wouldn't say black sheep, because that suggests maybe exactly. Something that's not right. I think Julia was... I think out of time is better. I think, really, she represents, if you like, whereas a lot of her generation would be looking to the old values, I think... Maybe not even knowing it herself, she was looking to the future and to something. She was picking up on what was happening, and it suited her personality more.
So how important was she to John at that period, at that moment?
I don't think you can ever underestimate the importance of your mum and your dad in your life. And I think, and I speak here as an adopted child, okay? I think Aunt Mimi was the absolute... foundation of John's life, and in many ways John knew what she was trying to do, and he appreciated and loved her for that. But you know, your mum is your mum, and the bond you have with her is very special. And if that bond is broken, even if John was lucky enough to have his mum in his come back into his life, but if it's broken, It does cause upset, but most of the time you're getting on with your life. You know, you have to, because you've got to survive, and that's very much the wartime spirit. So, Julie was hugely important to John.
I agree. I mean, I do think I don't think for a minute that John's moping around that it's an even integral part of his conversation. I'd not to pretend that at all, because that's just absolutely crazy. But I imagine. To know that you're living with your aunt and not your mom, to know that your mom's got a family effectively down the road, it has got to hurt. It's got to be something that you have to tamp down.
I think you do, because, as I say, you're living your life and you've got to get on with it. But I think...
But what do you know?
How do you mean, what do I know? Sorry, I didn't
John
understand.
See? What does John see about what I just described, right? I mean, paint for me a picture of the orbit of John's life. I mean, his mom's got another family, and he doesn't see her.
No, I mean, I'm sure that... I think that would confuse as much as anything. I think, you know, it's the age...
What would confuse?
Well, the fact that he's with his auntie and not with his mum. I think that is bound to... raise questions, but whether you'd ever ask those questions, I don't know. You'd suppress them, and as you're growing up into a situation, it is normal. It is not unusual. It's only as you get older that I think you begin to question this. And maybe as John was entering his teens, and particularly his mid-teens, he became more questioning. But of course, then Julia was taken.
How do you think that impacted him?
The loss of his mum?
Yeah.
Well, I think it would have devastated him. And, you know, I think he would have been adrift. But, you know, he has the rock of Mimi on which he's kind of moored. And that gives him the continuing stability. But I think inside, you know, you can only imagine that your mum, who's coming back into your life, is then ripped away. And we're not talking about a gradual. This is a sudden, violent ripping away. And I think that must have affected him very deeply.
Yeah, he had the rock of Mimi, and then he had the music.
Yeah.
Rock and roll, as it were.
Yeah, I think the music, something you can throw yourself into. And again, you know, you do these things often without consciously working it out that way. You are reacting, and John, you're striving. And John had said about Elvis that, you know, before Elvis he could see loneliness, I guess, through art and painting, but after Elvis he could hear loneliness. And I think within that quote, you have John expressing what is going on inside his heart and his mind. And, you know, it could only have been a totally confusing time, but music is the emollient which can help him see his way through.
Can you tell me a bit about, again, because there's going to be no narrator, about mm-hmm. how Julia died? It was not something, as you say, you know, it wasn't that there was an illness and that she had her family gather round and people were preparing
for No, it was just a normal day here at Mendips. From all that I can gather from reading what Mimi said and various documents and hearing what people have said, was that she had been here, John had been here, he'd been with his mum, but I think he'd excused himself to go down to Woolton to see his friends, and he'd agreed that he'd go over to Julia's house in Springwood, Blomfield Road, and he would see his sisters, who he's very fond of. And I think Bobby Dykins was going out to work that night, and so John would be there just in case Mum was late getting in from Mimi's. And I think that was the situation. But then...
what happened?
Here at Mendips, Julia realises the bus is due. I think she walks to the gate with Mimi. Mimi, in those days, there was a great tradition of escorting someone who'd been to your house to the bus stop. John would do it if he's here with his mum. Mimi would do it. But I think they were dashing to get the bus. Mimi had her slippers on. And so Julia went to the bus stop on her own. But as she left the house, she met Nigel Wally, who had come round to see if John was here. Nigel lived on Vale Road, which runs behind Mendips. And he was the manager, so-called, of the Quarrymen. And he and Julia walked along Menlove Avenue to where Vale Road was. Nigel said goodnight to Julia, goodbye, and was making his way up Vale Road. Julia proceeded to cross Menlove Avenue, which is a dual carriageway, and in the middle there's a green central reservation. And she had reached that point because she was crossing to the other side to get to a bus stop. And as she stepped off the reservation, or I don't know whether she was standing on it, a car hit her and I think more or less killed her outright. So that is how sudden and how violent it was. Yeah. To even think about it now, I think is quite, you know, horrific.
Right. And a total nightmare for all concerned.
Well, you know, that's it. Nothing can be reconciled, can it? All the things that are inside you, that are inside John, that are inside Mimi, with everyone who knows Julia, nothing can be reconciled, because that is it. It's over. It's instant. And I think that is what people have to deal with in such a situation. And it's a hard thing to deal with.
The terrifying irony for me in all of this is that it happens at a moment when Julia is re-establishing contact. It's not unlike John in 1980. There is a moment of Julia and John finally getting to be mother and son.
Mm.
And it's just taken from him as soon as he reestablishes it.
Mm. I think so, and it's the great question of what might have been. And I think that's also another thing you have to deal with. Whatever's gone before that you haven't sorted out remains unresolved. But then there's the great thing, what if? Yeah. You know, like people say, what if John hadn't been shot? What would he be doing? And I think for John and for Mimi and all members of the family, there would have been the great question, what if? What would life have been like? And of course it would have been different. And I would have...
I think John becomes unmoored. I mean, as much as Mimi is essential to him,
mm.
I think he doesn't have Freddie, he doesn't have a mom. I mean, you know, and I'm not diminishing Mimi and her love.
No, of course not.
But I think that, you know, when you're an orphan in the world,
mm-hmm.
you take more risks, you're more... You live life in a more dangerous, kind of mm. unbridled...
Well, way. I guess...
You don't have anybody saying, John, that's not who you are. Don't do that. Mimi could do it, but Mimi wasn't his mom.
No, I guess there's just always that thought of why.
Yeah, you know, I think about Paul and John. I mean, when we're done, I think that, you know, mm. the Beatles wouldn't have been the Beatles had they not both in some ways been orphans.
Well, it was the unspoken bond between them, wasn't there? I mean, I think they were very different as personalities.
But they could go out into the world untethered from their childhood.
Well, you know, untethered, or are you more tethered? You know? Are you more tethered? Is it something that is there that haunts you? And I think, you know, that is a very powerful thing, that in one way you are untethered. You can look around and say, well, nothing's holding me back now. You know, I'm just going to do it, because the example here is that, you know, life is not a certainty. It can be ripped away. But on the other hand, it's something that grounds you, because you come back to it time and time again, you know.
Well, certainly, I don't think John ever really was settled again until he had his own family in Sean. I think that he lived with tremendous pain, and
I'm sure, you know, there's a song that he wrote here at Mendip's called "I Call Your Name." Ostensibly, it's a love song, but "I call your name, but you're not there." Is, you know, I don't know whether rising from the subconscious, that kind of phrase comes from. The loss of Julia. There's no doubt about it. John's life was marked by tragedy. People being taken from him, almost like when his parents split up. Then his Uncle George, you know, Uncle George was a hugely important figure from all that I've read in John's life. And yet he dies prematurely. He was only in his early 50s, and yet here's a man with whom John has deep affection and has gone. And within 3 years, his mum's gone. And then Stuart Sutcliffe is taken. So for John, it must have seemed that everybody that people with whom he got close were taken.
Yeah.
And... I remember once talking to Astrid Kircher, and she said that when Stuart had died and John talked to her, he was a great comfort. But he did say to her, you've got a decision to make. You know, Stuart has died. Are you going to die with him, or are you going to go forward? Are you going to embrace life? And I think that is what John did. He embraced life.
And last question. I don't mm. want to paint this picture of a taut, sort of melancholy childhood, because this mm. was not what Mendip's was for him with me, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there. Yeah. I get the impression that the childhood that John had here was rich. I mean, Mimi's encouraging him with his art. You know, he's painting, he's drawing, he's creating. You know, he's got the goons coming at him. He's got the Life of the Lions. He coming out of the radio. They have a television. He's tuning into Lewis Carroll. I mean, here we, you know, this is wild stuff. It's very, very old stuff, but it's another door that's opening. and appealing to John, because it's a world that is turned on its head. You know, you fall down, as Mike said, you fall down a rabbit hole, and then you're in this world, you know, where all is just absolutely absurd. And then you've got the language of Lewis Carroll, and of course John loved all that kind of stuff, you know, where words are made up for their sound. Jabberwocky, 'twas brillig, and slithy toves did gyre and gimble, crabberlock a fishwife, pornographic priest. You know, this is an enrichment of John. When John was at school, the story was that he was at Quarrybank, that he was a boy who couldn't be harnessed. But you talk to his English teachers and Mr. Burroughs, who I think encouraged the boys to complete a book called My Anthology, which was a series of quotations from classic poems, and then you could illustrate them. And John did that. And his book was full of watercolours and cartoons illustrating these quotations. His teacher kept that book for years and would show it to subsequent generations of pupils as just how good you could make this book, and it was a wonderful example. So John then, you know, if you engaged him, if you could capture what made John tick, he was focused.
Okay, right. We don't have room, Tom. Are you going to need it? Okay.
I don't think I do, really. No.
Liverpool, sort of after the war. You were born in 38?
I was born in 38, yes. Yeah.
So give me some sense of Liverpool of the early 50s, the mid-50s. Is it a place of abundance? Just, you know?
Well, I wouldn't... You know, the war ended in 1946. 10 years later, the Quarrymen were formed, 56, weren't they now? Liverpool was actually flattened pretty much during the war. I don't know if you've seen any of those famous photographs of the city after the bombing, but I mean, there wasn't an awful lot of it left. So we were used to going into town and seeing lots of empty spaces. I mean, rationing carried on until about 1959. I think sugar was still rationed up until 1959. So Liverpool was a place that had been battered, and there wasn't an awful lot of money around to particularly rebuild it. And we were all sort of images of our parents, weren't we, you know.
So what did you do for fun when you were, say, 10, 12, you know, anywhere in that window?
Oh, we just played. By then I'd moved up to Walton, so there were cows and fields in Walton. So, yeah, we'd just play in the fields, climb over the farmer's fence and run across it, cow field and the rest of it, and play cricket on the field. Wander around Walton Woods. We just did things what kids did. That's when I moved to Walton.
Cowboys and Indians?
Cowboys and Indians. I mean, prior to that, when I lived in Bootle, we used to play in sort of derelict houses and bomb buildings and that. That was the thing that we did then. But when I moved up to Walton from Bootle, where I was born, it was just a different place altogether.
Well, John was in Walton.
John was already in Walton, yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, in Mendips.
You know, we spent some time at Mendips and on Menlove Avenue. It's not working class hero, is it?
I was just going to say that. I took the words right out of my mouth. There's certainly not a working class hero. I've always said that. I mean, in our time, Walton was separated from Liverpool by a lot of open space. I mean, over the years, the buildings have encroached. Walton's spread out. The city has spread out, and it's not so much isolated anymore. But in those days, it was pretty much a community on its own, Walton. That's why the Walton Fete was such a big thing, because everybody in Walton went to the fete. There wasn't much else to do throughout the year. You know, the trams used to go up, you know, and stop in Walton Village, and that as far as, you know, public transfer went. It stopped in the village, and the village was very much... Walton was very much isolated, so it was a different world, really.
A suburb?
Yes, yeah, very much. But it was even more than a suburb. It was more or less a village on its own. It was like an island on its own, separated by many miles from the city centre.
So what did that mean to live in Walton then? What was the sort of connotation? Was it like living in Speck? What was it? What was the kind of...
Well, I suppose coming from Bootle, where I'd played in bombed houses on bomb sites, I mean, to suddenly, you know, have a farmer's field next door to the house was quite, I suppose it was quite something. But I mean, when you're that age, 10, you don't really analyse that kind of stuff, do you?
You're just happy to be
there. I just knew it was happy to be there. And we got to know the kids in the row, the local kids, and they took me up to the farmer's field one day, and he said there was a crater there where a bomb had fallen, you know, and I'm thinking, one bomb. You know, Bootle and Bootle's docks got flattened, didn't they? And thought, you know, even at that age, I thought, what are they on about, one bomb?
You don't know.
You don't know, yeah, you don't know, yeah.
In my day, we would have four bombs for every one of these. But,
40.
Yeah. Give me some sense also, if you can, of, and I think Liverpool's very much lost this character now because the docks aren't what they used to be. But how important the docks were and how that defined Liverpool's character in some ways, right? I mean,
the docks, well, I'll go back a little bit. The docks are handling more tonnage now than they ever did, even during the boom years of the war. Because we were, the southern end of the country was too close to France, basically. So up around the corner into the Mersey, we were reasonably protected. So that's where all the American stuff used to come. Well, tons of American stuff came in. We've got all kinds of photographs of Edge Lane, where there's just American army trucks just, you know, stacked up. You know, it's a huge car park. You turn Liverpool into a huge car park. The cinema where I used to go in Allerton Road, I've got a photograph of planes coming down on the back of, you know, low loaders with the wings folded in. All American stuff all came through the docks.
During the war?
Well, during the war, yes, yeah.
And then after the war, the American influence in Liverpool just disappeared overnight?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say it disappeared overnight, because you had one of the biggest army bases in Europe at Burton Wood. You had one of the biggest indoor warehouses in Europe at Burton Wood. And, I mean, Burton Wood actually had its own bowling alleys and stuff. Now, we didn't have bowling alleys, did we? But certainly they had the dances where, you know, the local girls used to like to go and dance with the on the base with the Americans. So, no, it was a while before the Americans pulled out of Merseyside.
But their influence, and I don't mean the U.S. Army's influence, but I mean just American culture's influence, was that ever really far from the life of a Liverpoolian?
Well, only so much in the music, because we used to have what was referred to as Cunard Yanks. Now, these were the... Cunard was a big shipping line out of Liverpool. And the lads that did the regular trips from Liverpool to New York, they would go abroad in New York and they would buy American suits, American trilbies, American shoes. And they would bring comics back for their nephews and nets. And, of course, they would be American. And these lads got referred to then as Cunard Yanks because they were on the ships. But
what were they called?
Cunard Yanks. Because they went to America so much. So they dressed like Americans. They probably, some of them, tried to sound like Americans, but they were always very dapper.
And very flash.
Very flash, yeah. And bringing American comics back, plus records. So some of the very early records that came into Liverpool would have come through the sailors. You know, they would have given them to their nephews and nieces and whatever.
I mean, the fascinating thing for me in mid-50s, late-50s, is this idea that Liverpool becomes a kind of nexus for all that. You guys are soaking it all in, and eventually many bands sort of consume it and spit it out as a uniquely British staple. But for a time, it's not readily available. Few people have record players, although many do. And it's not on the radio, and there's no television to speak of.
No, certainly no television, no.
And yet, you were all eating this stuff up. And I'm just...
Well, it was probably coming in through the docks, as I say. Anybody that came on a ship back from America would have brought something with them, be it comics or records, certainly. And that was the way in. Plus, just down the road, we had this big American air base, Burton Wood. So they would have been getting their own supplies of stuff straight from the States. And if there was a dance on and the local girls or people went to the local dances, then stuff would have come out, I suppose. It would have been around.
And
we would have known about it.
Records were cheap for you or expensive for you?
Well, I wouldn't say they were cheap. I was working, you see, so I always had a few bob in my pocket. Certainly for John, they would have been very expensive records. But if somebody came up with a record and said, you know, the word spread around that, you know, Bill Smith got a record of Gene Vincent or something, well, that's, everyone would whiz up to his house just to listen to this record, you know.
And then pass it around, or?
Not necessarily pass it around, because you didn't necessarily want to lose it, you know. One way of losing stuff is to loan it around a bit, so. And you would forget who borrowed it, you know.
But so, you would all congregate at a...
That's right, we'd all head up there, you know, the quarryman would go to someone's house because we heard he'd just got a new record, a new American record, and you listen to it, and John would like it or not like it, you know. And if John liked it, well, he'd want to, you know, he'd want to learn it. I mean, if you got a record off the radio, I mean, it may only be played every 2 hours or something, so every other night, so you would only be able to scribble so much of it down before, you know, you lost the plot. Then you'd have to sit by the radio next night just waiting and waiting and waiting, hoping that they would play the same record so you could get the next verse down, scribble it down. But John was quite good. He sort of, if you got, you know, the main body of the song, what was missing, he'd just fill in. He'd make up, you know, he'd make it up as he went along.
That's fascinating. It's such a different world in as much that everything is accessible to you today. It's, you know...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think about, you know, I recently sort of reestablished my record collection after CDs and then the internet, and my children...
Wow, what's that?
What is it? It's, for them, it's a dinosaur. My daughter the other day was saying, oh, pause it. I have to go. I was like, no, you can't pause it. And even still, for me, you could put it on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sort of sense of availability to it. I'm sort of Julian's age, John's son. So, but for you, there's this sort of precious commodity that must have felt around this music, right? I mean,
well, we didn't really analyze it as precious commodity. I mean,
been something really precious. To get a handle on it, to get a hold of and they weren't even 45s, were they?
No, they were the 78s, the sort of the, you know, quite big ones, yeah, yeah.
So give me some sense of John and his musicality, or John and his guitar. I mean, he's not really a rhythm guitar player. He's not much of anything at this point, is he? Well, how did he play?
Well, when we first met, I mean, I got in the group because I had a set of drums. It didn't matter how badly I played them. I mean, the fact that I had drums was, they looked good, you know, on the back of the set and on the back of the stage. Eric Griffiths and John both went to guitar lessons to a guy in Hunts Cross, which was not far away. And they only had two lessons, and they realised it was going to take, you know, years before they could get on stage. They had a guitar. We just wanted to get up on a stage and perform to anybody. Didn't matter, you know, how little you played. We had a TTS bass, we had a washboard, you know, we had a couple of guitars, we had a banjo. Rod played banjo in the early days. I mean, his story is, he was asked to join the group and he went out and bought a banjo. I mean, that was the way it was. So Eric and John went to John's mum, Julia, and she taught them, she retuned the guitars banjo style, and she taught them banjo chords. So when we first started playing, John was learning off his mum just to play banjo chords on his guitar, as was Eric. And it wasn't until Paul came along and retuned and did, you know, 20 Flight Rock or whatever it was he played, and they all went, wow, you know, this guy can tune a guitar and he can actually play a guitar. And he knows all the words to 20 Flight Rock.
He's in.
He's in.
Yeah, no, he was a star, wasn't he, from the word go?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, he was. Yeah, I mean, John didn't take... you know, quickly to strangers. I mean, the fact that from one meeting at St. Peter's Church Hall, when Paul retuned his guitar and played, you know, 20 Flight Rock, with the left-handed guitar, actually, or right-handed guitar, whatever.
Yeah, you flip it, right?
That's how you flipped it, yeah. Which apparently, you know, well, that just blew everybody's mind, you see. This guy can flip a guitar and play guitar chords and tune it and knows all the words, so... The story is that on the way home, he was talking to Pete Schott and his mate and said, you know, what do you think about that guy, Paul? And Pete said, I think he's great. And they said, well, you know, should we have him in the band? And that was it, you know. Next time he saw him, he was invited to join the Quarrymen.
Pete invited him, I think, right?
Well, Pete reckons he met him on his bike and said, you know, do you want to join the group? And he thought about it for a minute and said, yeah, okay.
Thank God.
Thank God, yeah.
Yeah. But give me some sense then of how you guys would learn a tune. How would you do it?
Well, we'd end up at somebody's house. Now, if there was a record player around and we had a record, we would listen to it and sort of imitate it. But mostly John would probably, you know, learn something. And basically we just all sat around and someone would start, well, John would start singing and playing his guitar and we'd all just join in. With a bit of luck, we'd all finish about the same time. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing most of the time, but I just listened to the music and whatever I felt, I played. You know, once you do it half a dozen times, it's that's the set, isn't it? You know, you...
That's great. So give me some, did you know Julia well, or did you know her at all?
I didn't particularly know her well. I went up to Mendip's one late afternoon just to visit John, and he was coming out of the house at the time. And, you know, we said our hellos, and he said, I'm just going down to meet my mum. Do you want to come? And that was a bit of a shocker because I didn't know his mum lived down the road in Garston. I mean, we knew he lived with Aunt Mimi, but, I mean, you don't really question stuff like that, do you? You know, why is he living with your Aunt Mimi? You just take your friends as they are. I mean, I had a second mum. My mum died when I was, I don't know, 9 or 10 or something, and my dad remarried. So you don't really question your friends, do you? But he just said, I'm going down to meet my mum. So he invited me down to. So I went down to Julie's house, and I think she got a banjo out or took his... No, he didn't have his guitar. She had a banjo, I think, and she was going through some chords with him, you know, some music and... Just like a big sister, really. You know, it wasn't mother and son kind of situation. It just, you know, brother and sister almost.
Almost friends?
Oh, very friendly, yes, yeah. Very outgoing, yeah.
Did you get a sense at all from John that the situation, her absence, had been an issue, or was he just sort of...
No, it's something you don't, you know, you wouldn't sort of, you know, confide to your friends and you've got any kind of problem like that, no. That never came up.
I don't even sure he saw it as a problem, right?
Well, we don't know. You'd have to be inside John's mind to figure that one out, so we don't know. He should have never implied that it was a problem.
Mm. How was the relationship that you saw that afternoon, sort of, what, you know, in terms of Julia's interest in music? Did she tolerate or was she...
Oh, no, she was very enthusiastic about his music. She wanted him to, you know, she wanted him to do well. She wanted him to learn, well, certainly how to play the guitar banjo style and as many, you know, songs as he could learn. So, no, she was very enthusiastic. I mean, if Aunt Mimi had found him, you know, not being in school playing guitar, you know, she'd have read the riot act and sent him back to school. Julia, you know, come in, we'll just have a fun afternoon, you know. School, sad school.
Was Julia suspicious of Elvis as well and John's passion for Elvis?
I think she was just a bit concerned that John wasn't, you know, doing all the academic stuff that he should have been doing. I think she would have preferred him to.
No, I mean Julia. Did Julia?
Oh, sorry, Julia. No. She whatever John wanted to do, she was happy for him to do it. Music-wise, certainly, yeah. She was probably into Elvis herself. I mean, she was quite an outgoing young lady. I mean, she was a party girl. You know what I mean? She was a party girl.
I get the sense from looking at John's silly side and his magnetic side that you can get a glimpse into what Julia must have been like. That they're both nearsighted, and you know, there's moments when you see John kind of like mugging for the camera. And that kind of.
Well, I suppose that was just John, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. That sense of freedom at Julia's, that sense of, you know, you almost get the feeling that she's making up for lost time in some ways.
Yeah, well, possibly, but that's sort of hindsight. I mean, when I first met her, I didn't know that she'd been away for a long time and that they'd only just, you know, found each other again. There was none of that going on. You know, he just come and meet my mum, I went down, they played music and she was just happy to show John, you know, new chords or whatever.
This is 57?
Would be 57, yes. Yeah.
So when did you hear that John's mom had been hit by a car and had been killed? And how did you hear? Do you remember?
I don't really remember. I don't know who told me. Just remember going home and telling my parents that, you know. But I don't actually know where I hid it. It just, well, it was one of those things that just went round. Don't forget, Woolton was an island. It was quite a small community, you know, so word would have gone round fairly quickly.
Nigel was friends of yours as well?
Well, see, Nigel was really a close friend with John. As all the original quarry members were close friends, they'd all gone to school with John. They lived quite close to John. I mean, I was a bit of an outsider. You know, I'd come from Bootle. I moved into Woolton. I was slightly older than... I hadn't gone to their school. I'd started work. My only in was the fact that, hey, this guy's got a set of drums, you know. Could have been any drummer with a set of... Any lad with a set of drums then would have been in the quarrymen. Just the fact that I knew Rod and I knew Eric Griffiths. And it was Eric that sort of said, well, Colin's got a set of drums, you know, bring him in. So that's the only way I met Nige. It was through John. Nige Wally.
Yeah, yeah. So what did Nige ever tell you anything about that day? Or that evening? Did he...
I know it was some time after that he'd said that he was talking to outside Mendips, you know, walking to the corner and, you know, said the goodbye, she crossed the road and bang. I think he feels it a lot lately. You know, the last time I spoke to him, he did feel it quite a lot, you know. That if he'd have carried on talking for another 2 or 3 minutes, the car would have passed and, you know. If they'd have stood talking on that corner for another 2 or 3 minutes, the car would have passed, you know, when she went over to the bus stop, so. You know, he feels that perhaps if he'd have kept talking for a bit longer, she wouldn't have been knocked down by that car.
How did John respond?
I didn't see him going sort of... I've heard and read that he went off the rails, but I didn't think he went off the rails. He was obviously devastated, but it's difficult. See, you don't really analyse those kind of things with your friends, do you?
No.
I mean, John had been...
But you observe, you can see.
Yeah, but John had been to my house, you see, and he'd seen this young woman come in and out, and the lad said, hey, who's that? I said, well, that's my mum. What? Because, you know, my dad had remarried a much older, much younger woman, so...
Excuse me, we're talking here. Excuse us.
So when they first came up to the house and saw my mum, who was, considerably younger than my dad, they were quite shocked, so... I mean, John knew that my original mum was dead, so when we met, the quarrymen met up after the accident, I mean, there wasn't a lot to be said, you know. I just said hello to John. We just sort of looked at each other and got on with the rest of our lives, basically.
Very British.
I suppose so, stiff upper lip, I suppose. But I mean, what do you talk to about when you're that age? You know, you're only teenagers, you don't... I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Well, apart from that, yeah.
Did it affect John's friendship with Nige?
Nige thinks it did. I didn't think it did. I never noticed it, a drifting apart. I think Nige always felt... Nige felt a bit guilty. And when he thought that John, you know, was annoyed with him because he was there at the time, and John wasn't. Because Nige ran over, didn't he? And, you know, she was there. John wasn't. I don't know. We really don't know. We're going to have to talk to John and Nige on that one. Not an easy one to answer that one.
Yeah. No, fair enough. So, why did you end up leaving? Was it just too much trouble?
Well, it was all public transport for the start of, wasn't it? On and off buses with my drum kit, you know. And the old double-decker buses I used to get on, put my stuff under the stairs, go up on the top deck, have a smoke and get into town, come back down, take my drums off. And they were always still there. And it just got a bit. I mean, we'd been all over the place. We'd done lots of things. There was lots of talent contests that we never actually won. You know, we came second perhaps a few times, but we never actually won. We went to Manchester for a television audition, which didn't work out too well. And John told everyone it was my fault. When he got back to college, he told everyone it was my fault. But it wasn't my fault. It was just an excuse. No, we weren't going anywhere, were we? And I wanted to concentrate. Well, I was a tradesman, wasn't I? Getting on with my trade. I'd met the lady that I'd now married, you know. Who wants to be messing about with the quarrymen when you can be dating your girlfriend and going to the pitches? I remember going to the cavern. We played in the cavern. And as soon as we finished the set, I just packed up and dashed back to Woolton and went up to meet my girlfriend at the pitches, you know. So I wasn't, you know, hanging around with the lads anymore. And eventually I just thought, nah, I've had enough. And
what did they say when you told them you were moving?
Well, I didn't tell them, actually. I mean, it was one of those things. I left and they never write to me. But we went to a club in Broadway. No, it wasn't Broadway. I can't remember. Rodnell, no, Gilmore's. By then, I mean, Rod had left and Pete Shotton had left, Eric had left, and I'm missing one, aren't I? Eric Griffiths had left. So it was John Paul, George and myself. And we were still doing the same kind of rounds, you know, not particularly getting anywhere. I suppose you could say there was certainly an improvement, but, you know, it wasn't a long-term thing for me. Paul might have had ambitions and John might have had ambitions of being, you know, superstars, but it certainly wasn't within my mind. I thought we were just having fun because that's what we were doing. I mean, I've said in other interviews before the Quarrymen and, you know, the end of the war, it was all black and white. And then once skiffle and rock and roll started, it became technicolour. You know, it was just a whole new ball game. Everyone was just having fun. I've lost track of what I was thinking of now.
But that's a good thought. But, so it's...
Oh, the last time we played, I know.
There's the four of you. I mean, the crazy thing is that they then keep looking for a drummer. I mean, Stu joins, but he wasn't in there yet, was he?
No. And I'd left before Stu joined. It was still the four. I mean, that's what they said when they met George. We met George in a little grubby little club in town. And Eric was with us at the time. But then they wanted George to come in, but they didn't necessarily want to interrupt the three at the front, the lineup at the front. You know, Nigel came down to my house and said they want George in, but they want Eric to move on because they want to keep three across the front and you at the back. So I said, well, you know, whatever they want, they're running the show, you know. Eric wasn't too happy, but I said, Eric, I'm only there on borrowed time. Eventually we'll find a decent drummer, you know, and I'll be out, so... It was those three lads and then me. But George's dad was a bus driver. And in Gilmore's, there was the busman's social club, which had a really decent stage, proper curtains, you know. It was a great place to play. Really nice dressing rooms with pictures of all the stars, like, you know, Ken Dodd, and all those people that had been there before. And the Quarrymen were there, you see. And we went on and we were supposed to do five songs, which we did our five songs. And then... The guy was pulling the curtains, he got stuck at the curtains and they wouldn't close. So John just said, you know, well, while he's fighting the curtains, we'll do another song. And we just played another song till he sorted the curtains out. And when we went off, that was great, brilliant spot, lads. There's a pint for you at the bar, you see. Well, it was the worst thing anybody could have said to us lads, that there's a pint at the bar, because you don't stop at one, do you? So I was pelatic, John was pelatic, and Paul was pelatic. The only sober lad on the stage, the second half, was George, unfortunately. He must have been totally embarrassed with his mum and dad sitting in the audience. But, of course, the second half was a disaster, wasn't it? Complete disaster. So then we went into the dressing room when we came off, and the guy said, oh, you're blowing it there, lads, you're right balls up. But what I didn't know, and nobody told me, was that there was a guy, there was a place called the Pavilion, up top of Smith Down Road. It used to be a cinema, and it turned into a bingo hall, which that was happening at the time. The cinemas were closing down, bingo halls were coming on. And he wanted to hire a regular group to play every night in the bingo hall between games, you see. And he'd come from the bingo hall to see the Quarrymen, right? Now, nobody told me that. So this guy said, all I can do is ask him to come and have a talk to you, see. So he came in. And you know when you're having a great time and you're really on a high and suddenly... You know, this has been a balls up, and you start, you know, going lower. You know, after the big high, you've got the downs, haven't you? And John was sitting in the corner, and this guy came in, and he had, you know, makeup on for his cheeks, you know, for being on stage. And of course, John was just taking the piss out of him, something shocking, you know. And he said, if I hadn't have seen the first half, he said, which I thought you were bloody good. Now, bloody good in those days, people didn't swear, really. So that was really emphasising on that he'd seen what he thought initially was a good show, a bloody good show, he said. He said, but the second half, you know, you can't do that. You can't do that to an audience. And he started to lecture, and John's saying, oh, piss off you, and stuff like that, you know. So that was the end of that. So from being really having a great time, well, we had a great time at the interval because we were all getting pissed, weren't we, in the dressing room and dancing on the tables and that, you know. And
then was John a bit of a loudmouth? I mean,
it could be, especially if he'd had a couple of drinks. He could speak his mind. If I don't know, he could speak his mind, John. He didn't. He wasn't necessarily diplomatic. So that was it. We just, you know, started to fall out a bit, and on the bus home, you know.
Because you thought, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah,
either
I suppose
you're
so.
A professional, you're not going to be a pro.
Well, I mean, I couldn't. I mean, to be honest, most of the time I was drunk, so I couldn't criticise the other lads, because I played drums mostly drunk. But I didn't know that this was a big deal, you see, that this was not only a show, it was also a big audition for this guy. If he'd done a decent second half, he might have said, well, you've got a regular gig at the thing, and who knows, might have gone on from there. But on the way home, there was things said on the bus, you know, I just got off the bus and I said, oh, you know, not going back from there, and put my drums on top of my wardrobe and left them there. I never talked to them again, they never contacted me, so.
Anything you think we missed?
When we talked beforehand, just about records and what kind of line, but...